John S. Doyle is with us with a first look at what it says in this morning's newspapers.
There's a variety of lead stories in the papers. For the Irish Daily Mail, the main focus is on Maria Bailey, Fine Gael TD in Dunleary. Swinggate TD has been dramatically axed as a candidate for the next general election, is how the paper puts it. As Emma Jane Haid reports, the decision to drop her was taken at a private meeting of the party's executive council in Dublin last night. Ms. Bailey immediately hit back, criticising the Fine Gael hierarchy's handling of the issue, the paper says, and she said she would now take time to reflect on the matter. The Irish Independent's political correspondent John Downing comments that one would be inhuman not to have some sympathy for Maria Bailey's suffering, but she was also the author of her own downfall. And he says there is no doubt that this drawn-out saga was allowed to go on for too long. A director of Quinn Industrial Holdings has said that many of the death threats made to the directors of the company were communicated face-to-face and then reported to police. So the Irish News reports in its lead story. John McCartan, a former Fine Gael councillor in County Leitrim, said he was repeatedly threatened by people he later identified to Gardaí. The paper reports that while welcoming the arrests yesterday in the investigation into the abduction and assault of Kevin Lunny, Mr. McCartan said he feared the police in action meant the trail had gone cold on a lot of the information he provided since 2015. A Garda spokesman told the news it does not comment on remarks by third parties, but he said the Commissioner, Drew Harris, was happy with the progress of the investigation. The Irish Daily Mirror reports sources as revealing that information on mobiles belonging to Cyril McGuinness, found during the raid on his house last Friday in connection with the investigation into the attack on Kevin Lunny, led to the arrests of two men and a woman yesterday. In the Irish Examiner, it is reported that the Garda Ombudsman, GSOC, is looking into whether Gardaí properly investigated the complaint of a woman who said she had been repeatedly contacted by a judge who was dealing with her family law case. The woman alleges that the judge had contacted her by text and phone after she appeared before him. The report is by Michael Clifford, and he goes into the detail of the allegations on an inside page. Get over the tracker rate scandal, says the lead headline in the Irish Independent. That advice is a summary of the words of the head of the Belgian bank KBC, who the paper says has dismissed the central bank's crackdown on mortgage overcharging as annoying and called on Irish regulators to turn the page. What reporter Sean Pogachnik calls the tone-deaf remarks of Johan Theiss came as the lender's Irish unit set aside another €18 million in expectation that a central bank fine could soon come for its role in blocking or removing customers from low-interest tracker mortgages a decade ago. The scandal has years to run in the courts, the paper says. People seeking to become Irish citizens will be relieved by the Court of Appeal overturning a ruling which stated that they could not leave the state at all in the year preceding their application. So the Irish Times reports in its lead story, quoting organisations working with migrants. The three-judge court described the ruling in July by Justice Max Barrett in the High Court, which caused major uncertainty among applicants, as unworkable, unduly rigid and an interpretive absurdity. Terror at Tedfest is the headline in the Irish Sun. Gordon Deegan reports from Ennis Circuit Court, which heard yesterday that a drunken farmer pulled a fake gun from his pants during a violent row over cow dung at a popular Father Ted tribute event. There was a lot of walking wounded, a Garda told the court. The judge imposed a fine of €1,000 on the farmer.
Dunleary TD Maria Bailey won't be a candidate for Fine Gael at the next general election. The decision was taken by the party's national executive last night after a recommendation by Fine Gael president and Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. Her position had been under pressure after revelations of a personal injury claim over a fall off a swing in a Dublin hotel emerged shortly before this year's local and European elections. We contacted Maria Bailey to ask her to talk to us this morning, but there was no response. We contacted Martin Hayden, the chairman of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party, and there was no response. Fine Gael Press Office replied to our requests by saying they were not putting anyone forward. Fine Gael Senator Michelle Mulhern on Virgin Media last night said she was disappointed for Maria Bailey.
I think the coverage of what has happened to her hasn't been proportionate or fair. This is going on since last May, and it has been incessant. the sort of coverage she's got, the abuse she's got. And I seriously wonder if she was a man, if she would have got it.
Let's talk now to our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. Morning, Paul.
Good morning.
What happened last night?
Last night, the National Executive Council of Fine Gael met at its headquarters in Mount Street. The council is made up of Oireachtas members, councillors, ordinary party members, and also some party officials. They considered a recommendation from the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, and that stated that Maria Bailey should be removed from the Dunleary constituency ticket for the next general election, and that she should be replaced by a local councillor, Jennifer Carroll McNeill. What was a little bit different to the usual proceedings was that Maria Bailey was allowed to address the council. She's not a member of the NEC and therefore wouldn't have any rights, but she turned up at the building and was allowed to go in and address people, and she made her case. And after that, she left and the council continued with its business, and it decided to endorse what the Taoiseach had recommended as president of the party. And as you said, Maria Bailey is now no longer able to defend her seat in the upcoming general election.
Paul, do you know what she told the meeting or how she was received?
We know that she was received quietly, respectfully. She was able to make her case. But there wasn't any follow-up questions. There wasn't any brouhaha afterwards. She made her case. She left. The council continued and took its decision.
As Michelle Mulhern pointed out, this case has been very drawn out for Fine Gael and for Maria Bailey. Is it over now?
Well, I think Maria Bailey, in her statement, which was released just after 9 o'clock, and actually before the Fine Gael's own statement, she was pointing out to the fact that this had been a matter which she had believed had been concluded in July, that the Taoiseach had undertaken a report, and there had been an investigation. They'd arrived at a conclusion that she should stand down from the Oireachtas Housing Committee, and the Taoiseach had told her that the matter had been concluded. In her statement, Miss Bailey alludes to the fact that what she terms anonymous sources, however, within the party kept this going, and ultimately it led to a meeting of constituency members in Dunleary, and they said they called for an urgent review by the Executive Council of their general election ticket. And you can see from Miss Bailey's statement, she felt that the procedures which were adopted at that particular meeting she had significant issues with. In stating that, that sort of leaves open or raises the question as to whether or not she wants to take any action on foot of what she believes to be a meeting which wasn't handled correctly. But certainly from Fine Gael's point of view, they are hoping that this will draw the line under the matter, and that Ms Bailey is able to continue as a TD, she's able to continue in the Fine Gael parliamentary party. But after that, the party moves on with a new candidate, and they hope that the story will die.
Procedures aside, why has Maria Bailey been dropped from the Fine Gael election ticket?
What's been clear from senior Fine Gael ministers for the past couple of weeks, ever since that meeting on Halloween by the Dunleary constituency members, was that it is the members of Fine Gael who select their candidates. And the fact that the members of Fine Gael had said that they were looking for an urgent review, and effectively stating that they had lost confidence in Maria Bailey, that Fine Gael was acting on their desire. So that's what makes it different. It is accurate to say that the Taoiseach had dealt with it in July internally, but once you lose the support of your own members in the constituency, then the National Executive Council and the President of the party will adhere to what the members' wishes are. So that's the difference between the two timelines, between October 31st when the constituency members met, and earlier in July when the Taoiseach sanctioned her.
Will she run again?
It's unclear. I thought that it was notable in her statement that she says that she is a proud member of Fine Gael, that she thanked the members of Fine Gael for her support, that she thanked the National Executive Council for allowing her to speak last night. It didn't strike me as someone who was outraged at her position and was going to head off and become an independent and stand for the people of Dunleary, feeling that she had been treated unfairly and therefore wanted to move forward. It sounded to me as if someone who was, as she said, you know, leaving the door open to remaining in Fine Gael, leaving the door open to a possible return. But she did say in her statement that she was reflecting on her position, so maybe it's just the case that she hasn't reached a decision.
Paul, do you know, does she remain in the Fine Gael parliamentary party between now and the election, whenever that is?
Yes, that's as I understand it. She remains a member of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party for as long as that she wishes to. If it's the case that she wants to remove herself from that, that's a decision for her. But the party is not going to make any decision to exclude her. And that is a strange scenario in which she can remain a member of the Parliamentary Party, the same party which doesn't believe that she can stand and defend her seat.
Paul, thank you for that. That's our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
The British-Irish Council meets in Dublin today with political leaders from Ireland, Scotland, Wales, England and the Channel Islands taking part, but not from Northern Ireland because of the continued suspension of Stormont. Brexit is expected to dominate today's meeting, which will be chaired by the Taoiseach and attended by the Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith representing England and Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. Let's talk now to our Northern editor Tommy Gorman. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning, Brian.
This body was set up under the Good Friday Agreement 20 or more years ago. Of course, in very different times, Brexit, we know, will fundamentally change the relationship between our islands and within our islands. So no surprise that Brexit is expected to top the agenda.
That's right, Brian. It's the 33rd meeting of this organisation, and really it was set up to try and improve and develop East-West relations. But it's significant that against the shadow of Brexit and the upcoming British general election, Michael Gove, a very senior Conservative minister who was due to travel, he pulled out at the last minute. So Julian Smith will be representing the British government. I suppose one of the key players in this will be Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's First Minister. She'll be hoping that her party will have a good Westminster election, because on her shopping list, and very high on it, is the thought of having a referendum in Scotland on leaving the United Kingdom. So it'll be interesting to hear what she has to say. The Taoiseach will be chairing the discussions, and because I think of the British general election, I think they'll have mannerly discussions against Brexit, but you don't see any real progress being made. It'll be an interesting opportunity for further discussions, and I suppose for further chemistry between the Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith, who will be representing the British government's interests, because he has made quite a significant impact in Northern Ireland since he took over from Karen Bradley.
Well, as you say, the election will be very much, one imagines, on the minds of the British participants at this meeting. Nominations have now closed in the UK general election, so we have the final lineup, particularly in Northern Ireland, in what promises to be some very competitive election contests in a number of northern constituencies.
Yep, Brian, nominations closed yesterday, and there are 102 candidates in the 18 constituencies. And I'll just give you what I think are going to be the top five battlegrounds. Belfast North, where Nigel Dodds of the DUP is the sitting MP, there are just three candidates, and Sinn Féin is going to, they're attempting to take him out. They've put up John Finucane as their candidate. There's only one other candidate, Nuala McAllister of Alliance. And this constituency was 50.3% for Remain, 49.7% for Leave in the Brexit referendum. And it's really going to be a battle of heavyweights. And remember, Nigel Dodds is the DUP's deputy leader, their leader in Westminster. So that's one to watch. Next one up, Belfast South. That's currently held by Emma Little-Pengelly of the DUP. But it was a pro-Remain constituency, almost 70%. And the big challenge to her is coming from Claire Hannah of the SDLP, the chance for the SDLP to get at least one MP back. Next up, Foyle. Huge battle between nationalists. A column east with the SDLP leader trying to regain the old John Hume, the old Mark Durkin seat, trying to oust Sinn Féin's Alicia McCallion. Seven candidates in that constituency, so where the other votes go will be interesting there. One significant player, Anne McCluskey of Pathertobin's Ain't Two Party. She took 3,000 votes at one stage in the Assembly election. What influence will she have? Fourth interesting one, the old dogfight of Fermanagh, South Tyrone. It has moved from Sinn Féin to Ulster Unionists, over and back, over and back. Michelle Gildernew, the sitting Sinn Féin candidate, big challenge to her coming from Tom Elliott of the Ulster Unionists, and no DUP candidate there. So the ground cleared for this battle, really, between the UUP and Sinn Féin. And finally, Belfast East. Just three candidates there. Naomi Long of Alliance trying to take the seat of Gavin Robinson of the DUP. Bit of a stretch for her. Gavin Robinson is quite popular. But remember, at one stage, what was it, 2010? Naomi Long took the seat from Peter Robinson. Maybe I should mention a sixth. That's North Down, where Sylvia Herman was the outgoing independent unionist. She's not standing. And there's a chance there that the DUP's Alex Easton could actually make a gain there for the DUP. So if they had a loss maybe in the likes of South Belfast or indeed North Belfast, the DUP could get one back there. But fascinating contests all over the place, Brian.
All right, plenty to watch for in the weeks ahead. No doubt we'll be hearing from you and our reporters on those election contests in due course. Thanks indeed for that, Tommy Gorman.
A man who harassed six female writers and journalists by sending them hundreds of abusive messages over 6 years has been jailed for 3 years. Dublin Circuit Criminal Court heard that 37-year-old Brendan Doolan left his home only twice in the 17 years before his crimes were investigated. Judge Martin Nolan said his behaviour towards Sarah Griffin, Kate McAvoy, Sinead O'Carroll, Christine Bowen, Roe McDermott and Aoife Barry was gravely reprehensible because he persisted in communicating with them for so long despite repeated requests to stop. Roe McDermott said, "Every single time he sent a nasty message to me, every time he invoked my personal traumas to insult me, every single time he jeopardized my career by messaging my workplace, every time he risked damaging my personal reputation by messaging people in my life, I believe Brendan Doolan was trying to harass me into silence." The six women issued a joint statement. It's read here by one of them, Christine Bowen.
"Brendan Doolan's campaign of harassment against us went on for years. We hope that this case shows other men and women in this situation that what they say will be taken seriously if they come forward, and that online harassment is harassment and will be treated as such. We hope Brendan Doolan receives the help and rehabilitation that he needs. We'd like to thank Detective Garda Colin Gallagher and his colleagues at the Cybercrime Unit for their painstaking work on and a sensitive approach to this case."
Dr. Mary Aiken is a cyber psychologist and a honorary professor in the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London. Mary Aiken, good morning again. Thanks for taking your call.
Good morning.
Is this case unique?
I think it is. I think it's a major breakthrough. I think it's a step forward in the real world and a giant step forward in cyberspace. I think for the first time, you know, it's an example of consequences for these types of behavior online, these types of behavior in cyberspace. The point is that deterrence is a central principle, you know, in terms of any criminal justice system. And that works on the premise that the threat of punishment will deter people from committing crime and reduce the probability and level of offending in society. In this case, is now showing that there are consequences for the offender's behaviour, and hopefully going forward, deterrence as a principle will work.
The extent of contact from this man over many years to the women is extraordinary. Although, as I said, the judge said he never left his house only twice in 17 years, the women were made to feel that he was a constant and a threatening presence in their life for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, this case is a mixture of online harassment, of trolling, and of cyber stalking, and a toxic combination of all three, which could be terrifying for the victims.
If this sets a legal precedent here, what are the implications of this judgment going forward?
Well, it's very interesting, as it comes at a time whereby the government are looking at amendments to the Harassment, Harmful Communications and Related Offences Bill 2017. And in fact, the Joint Committee on Justice and Equality have just basically wrapped up their hearings. I actually testified on this matter last month to that committee. And it's going to raise, yes, an interesting legal precedent, but additionally, it's also going to raise the question of how are the Gardaí going to deal with these problems in terms of if online harassment or cyberbullying is criminalised. Because the problem is, essentially, these are big data problems. And that means sort of extremely large data sets in a cyber context. Let me give you an example. Facebook has 2.5 million users in Ireland. If on a Monday morning 10% of them got onto the Gardaí to complain, I think I've been harassed or bullied online, that would be 250,000 complaints. If even 1% complained on a Monday morning, that would be 25,000 complaints. Our Gardaí are simply not resourced to deal with this sort of tsunami of complaints.
While this case is unique in terms of it having been followed through to conclusion, it's not unique in terms of the type of abuse that was involved. You tweeted yourself last night in response to this case, finally consequences for trolling, victims felt like they were under surveillance. I know that feeling. Can you tell us more?
Oh, certainly. You know, there's a cohort that operate online that as soon as you say something in an interview or write an article or appear on television, that they will jump in and attempt to troll you. But, you know, I'm a cyber behavioral scientist. I'm resilient. When you troll me, all you do is give me data and lots of it. But I'm very concerned about people who have less resilience and less coping skills. And if you read the impact statements of the victims in this question.
Yes.
And let's remember, these were professional journalists, you know, used to robust engagement online, used to debate, used to defending their opinion, and they were traumatized by what happened. Now, let's imagine an 8 or 9 or 10 or 11-year-old child being the victim of such abuse without having the coping skills. That's the part that really, really worries me.
Mary, thank you for talking to us again. That's Dr. Mary Aiken. She's a cyber psychologist and honorary professor in the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London.
Take a first look at the business headlines this Friday morning with Adam McGuire. Adam.
Thanks, Brian. Two British firms have announced takeovers this morning. Carpetright has agreed to a £15.2 million acquisition by Meditor Holdings Limited. They're a subsidiary of investment firm Meditor Fund, which already has a link to Carpetright through a £25.7 million loan agreed in May of last year. Carpetright operates 449 stores, including 20 in Ireland. Meanwhile, Eddie Stobart Logistics has agreed to sell a 51% stake in a subsidiary to Douglas Bay Capital. As part of the deal, the investment company will inject around £55 million of funding into the group. Elsewhere, 15 countries have sought compensation over Brexit, claiming they have lost trade as a result of ongoing delays. Countries including Australia, the US, India and Brazil have raised concerns around Britain's departure from the European Union at the World Trade Organization. Many of those relate to the tariff and goods quotas in place between the EU and third countries, which will have to be rearranged as a result of Brexit. Finally, for now, the currencies, €1 buying you $1 and 10.2 cent and 85.6 pence sterling.
Des Cahill's here. We're kind of getting used to beating New Zealand in November now, aren't we?
Yeah, we kind of are, but it was our first victory over New Zealand. The All Whites, they wear white, obviously. The basketball team New Zealand is known as the Tall Blacks, which is one of the great sporting names. But anyway, Ireland won 3-1 in last night's friendly, despite Ireland going behind to a Callum McCowatt goal. The inexperienced side dominated the game from Ireland. Very comfortable winners. They played well, I have to say. Enjoyed watching them. There were three first-time goal scorers for Ireland. Derek Williams of Blackburn, who levelled the game at 1-1 just before half-time. Then in the second half, Preston's Shawnee Maguire and Callum Robinson of Sheffield United, they added two more. Maguire's goal was a great goal from the edge of the box. He was named man of the match. But really, the big talking point for the crowd was the appearance of Troy Parrott in his first start for the Irish senior side. He's doing wonders at Tottenham. He's only 17 years old and he was delighted with how it went.
Words can't describe, to be honest. All week just training and stuff, and then to finally get out there onto the pitch and see the fans and stuff walking out in that green jersey, it's no better feeling.
You're only 17. You don't look it. You don't act it. I mean, you seemed like unfazed by the occasion.
I just try to go out and do my best. That's all I can do, and just enjoy it. And everyone's saying in the change room, go and enjoy the game, and just do what I normally do. And that's what I try to do. And it's good to get the win on the debut. And obviously, I think I put in a good performance.
You ran the line well. You got into the channels, and it was quite a positive performance from Ireland tonight.
Yeah, it was. I think it's good to get the win before going into obviously the big game on Monday, and just obviously going into it positive and stuff like that. So it's good, yeah.
Did you feel like you belonged?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't want to come off the pitch, to be honest.
Well, I'm sure it's the first of many. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was a lovely warm interview. I'm just saying here, at 17, like, that's kind of when you're in fifth year in school. It gives a kind of context of what an achievement it is for him to play for Ireland. Elsewhere, England, the Czech Republic, Turkey and France all secured their places at next summer's European finals. England won 7-0 against Montenegro at Wembley. Harry Kane scored a first half hat-trick. France came from a goal down to win 2-1 at home to Moldova. The holders, Portugal, were 6-0 winners at home against Lithuania. Another hat-trick in that one for Cristiano Ronaldo, the 55th of his career and his 98th international goal. Portugal need a draw in their final game to secure a place in next summer's finals. Now, tonight there are two games of huge significance in Ireland's group. Denmark host Gibraltar and Switzerland are at home to Georgia. At the moment, Ireland and Denmark are on 12 points. Switzerland are on 11, but Ireland have played a game more. So if, as expected, Denmark and Switzerland win their home games tonight, the group would change significantly. It would be Denmark on 15 points, Switzerland on 14 and Ireland on 12. And in that case, Ireland must beat Denmark on Monday. The Irish 21s won again yesterday. The 1-0 win in Armenia means Ireland continue to top the group, although Ireland have played more games. Tonight, the Irish under-17s play Montenegro at Turner's Cross in the European qualifier. Now, in tennis, Roger Federer stunned Novak Djokovic to reach the semi-finals at the AP Tour Finals in London. His victory also ends the Serbians' bid to finish the year as world number one. 38-year-old Swiss came through a straight shootout in the group stage with his great rival winning their 49th meeting, 6-4, 6-3. So Rafa Nadal will now end the year at the top of the world rankings. In snooker, the Northern Ireland Open in Belfast saw a surprise defeat from Mark Allen, who lost 4-3 to outsider Alexander Ursenbacher of Switzerland. Ken Doherty was beaten 4-1 by Mark Selby. In rugby, the European Champions Cup gets underway this evening. The opening match sees Gloucester host Toulouse. Of course, all four Irish provinces are in action over the weekend. We'll have more on that later in the programme. In racing, Horse Racing Ireland confirmed last night all registrations under the Supreme Racing Club banner have been voided following the failure of the club's trustee to provide HRI with information requested. It means their 14 horses, including big Cheltenham hopeful Kemboy, will not be permitted to race in Ireland. Duvan made a winning return to action at Clonmel after more than 500 days of inactivity. The dual Cheltenham Festival winner recorded a 9.5 lengths win over Jet in the Clonmel Oil Chase, producing some fine jumping. Now, having won the Unibet Morgiana hurdle at Punchestown for the first time in 2011 with 1,000 stars, Willie Mullins has been unbeaten in the race, winning it three times with the great Hurricane Fly, twice with Nichols Canyon, and over the past 2 years with Faheen and Sharjah. Well, Mullins has a strong hand once again in tomorrow's renewal, with Sharjah bidding to win back-to-back, while 2020 champion hurdle favourite Classical Dream also lines up for the big race. Mullen spoke about his three contenders for the first Grade 1 contest over hurdles in Ireland this season.
It's always the best time of the year in the training yard, the National Hunt Yard anyhow, because everything is fit and well, and we haven't raced them or we haven't galloped them too hard yet, so they're all in real good shape. Classical Dream is good and strong and well. I mean, last year our horses were sort of treading water so much because we didn't get any rain. This year they look to be in the place that I want them at this point in time. We don't want to forget Sharjah, who won it last year. We don't want to forget Saldier, who fell, I think, going to challenge Esport Allen in Nace last year and broke his nose and kept him out for the rest of the season, but he seems to be fine now and coming back to himself. You know, he's a horse that we thought was good enough last year to be in those type of races, so I'm looking forward to getting him out this year.
Now, today's opening day of Cheltenham's November meeting has been cancelled because of the rain. Courses flooded in places. A second inspection will be conducted today to determine if racing can go ahead tomorrow. But racing does, of course, go ahead in Dundalk this evening. The first race is at 5:15, Brian.
Thank you indeed, Des. Talk to you again in an hour from now. Spain remains without a new government a week after the country's fourth general election in as many years. After another inconclusive result, the ruling socialists, under Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, agreed a coalition deal with the anti-austerity party Podemos. But the two will need the support of smaller parties if they're to form a government. So what are the prospects of an administration being formed, and why is Spain experiencing such consistent political instability in recent years? Well, in studio we're joined by Dr. Charles Powell from the Royal Elcano Institute in Madrid and Professor of Spanish History at the CEU San Pablo University. He's here to address the Institute of International and European Affairs later this morning. A very good morning to you, Dr. Pallin. Thank you for coming in to talk to us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Perhaps we can talk about the immediate issue first of all, the prospect of Spain having a government when the Parliament reconvenes in 2 weeks' time and its possible composition. How are things looking?
Well, at the moment, what we have is the Socialist Party, which has, as you've mentioned, reached a deal with Podemos. But in order to be able to form a government, they're going to need the support of a plethora of smaller regional parties, plus the abstention, and this is the real sticking point, of the largest Catalan nationalist party, Esquerra Republicana de Catalunya, which obtained 13 votes in the recent election. So basically, this, if it goes ahead, this would be a left, clearly a leftist government, a progressive government, as the Prime Minister is describing it. It would also be an unstable government, probably, because it would rely on the support of 7 or 8 smaller parties. And interestingly, it would be the first coalition government in Spanish history since democracy was restored in 1978.
To what extent is Catalan separatism, the rise of this demand for Catalonia to be independent, becoming one of the main polarizing issues in Spanish politics? Because another feature of this recent election was the rise of the right-wing party Vox. They're now the third biggest party in Parliament.
That's right. They're the third party with about 15% of the vote and 52 seats. Well, if I can take you back a little bit, traditionally, Spain had one of the most stable and predictable political systems in Europe, in which a conservative and a left-wing party alternated in office. And when they didn't have enough votes to form a majority, they would rely on, normally, a small Catalan nationalist party to make up for the difference. Now, this is no longer feasible because all of the major Catalan parties now support independence, with the exception of the Catalan Socialists, that is. So this has introduced an element of instability. Additionally, Catalonia has cast a very long shadow on Spanish politics generally. And I would say that 80% of Vox voters basically vote for them out of a sense of outrage with what's happening in Catalonia. They think that the Madrid government has been too weak on the separatists, and I think they were particularly horrified by the street violence that we saw in Barcelona during the last couple of weeks.
Is the effects of austerity in Spain still a very live political issue? The strength of Podemos, for example, and the sluggishness, if you like, of the Spanish economic recovery?
Well, the economic recovery was actually quite strong, and Spain has been growing well above the Eurozone average over the last 5 years or so. But it's true that Spain's six-year-long double-dip recession starting in 2009 has had a brutal effect. The country lost 10% of its national wealth. Unemployment reached 26%.
And remains
at 14%, which is one of the highest in the EU. So there's a structural unemployment issue. And it was actually, I think, that six-year-long crisis which did most to undermine the traditional two-party system. That's when Podemos emerged. And in general, it's led to the current situation of extreme polarization. Today, Spain has one of the most polarized political systems in Europe, as many as 16 political parties in the Congress of Deputies. And I think, yes, I mean, the underlying reason for that was essentially the social reaction to the economic crisis.
And forcing political parties into alliances they perhaps wouldn't have contemplated before now. I noticed that Mr. Sanchez, earlier on in the year, said that he'd have trouble sleeping at night if he had Podemos ministers in his government, and that's been cast aside.
Absolutely, yes. It's a bit embarrassing for him, I suppose. And a lot of people are wondering, you know, why didn't he choose the other option, which would have been a sort of German-style grand coalition with the Conservatives? Because the two largest parties, the Socialists and the Conservatives, would have had a very broad majority in Parliament if he had done that. But as a result of the growing polarization, this was something that he wasn't even willing to contemplate. However, let's not automatically assume that he is actually going to be able to form a government. If the Catalan nationalists do not abstain, he may, at the end of the day, still be forced to seek the support of the Conservatives in order to form a more stable, long-term coalition.
Just a word about the possibility of some alliance on the right, the People's Party and Vox, for example, getting together. Is that at all on the cards?
They don't add up. So there are three parties on the right now, the Popular Party, or the People's Party, Ciudadanos, which was an important centre party but has now practically collapsed and only has 10 seats, and Vox. So these three parties are in coalition elsewhere, for example in Andalusia in the south, but right now they don't have enough support in Parliament to form a coalition of their own.
It sounds like we can expect a continued political instability in Spain for the time ahead, for the foreseeable future.
Well, I'm afraid you may well be right. I think nobody wants yet another election. That would be, imagine having three elections in a year. That would be intolerable. But at the same time, in a context of extreme polarization, it's very difficult to see and to be optimistic about the short-term prospects.
Professor Charles Powell from the Institute, the Elcano Institute in Madrid. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning on Morning Ireland.
Adam Maguire is back with more business news.
Thanks, Gavin. Most engineers here are anticipating their bottom lines to grow over the next year. That's despite various economic headwinds like Brexit and global trade wars. Ahead of its annual Excellence Awards, Engineers Ireland has published a survey of its leading members, with 69% expecting finances to improve in 2020. However, the country is struggling to keep up with that level of growth, almost half of respondents looking abroad for new workers. I'm joined now by Caroline Spillane, Director General of Engineers Ireland. Caroline, more than two-thirds of the people you surveyed expecting growth next year. Given all of those economic headwinds and that uncertainty in the economy, what's making them so confident?
Well, I suppose what we can gather from this survey is their confidence is in relation to their financial performance this year and projecting into next year, and in their willingness to recruit. And I suppose that reflects the range of projects that engineering companies are involved in and engineers in general. So we can see strong growth across manufacturing, construction, consultancy, ICT, pharma and energy. And then we're also seeing a sentiment from recruiters in areas such as the public sector and utilities, which perhaps reflects some of the investment that is coming down the line as part of Project Ireland 2040. So all of these are very positive things, but I suppose I would caveat it that even though it is positive going into 2020, it's not as positive as it was in the background. And I suppose the constraints to growth are around recruitment, and they're around those wider economic factors.
We'll get on to recruitment in a minute, but in terms of the types of projects, you list some of the areas there, but has the makeup changed in terms of the types of projects that your members tend to be dealing with now compared to maybe 5 or 10 years ago?
Well, I suppose the big change is technology, and in particular the impact of digitalisation on the engineering profession. So this is going across all sectors and it's going across all types of projects. So we can see now with engineers, you know, they're challenged not only to be involved in purchasing technology but also in actually utilising it. So 3D printing, robotics, artificial intelligence, blockchain, all of these things are areas where engineers now are required to have competence in.
What about sustainability? A lot of talk by businesses about going green, but is that actually translating through to the projects that they're putting on your members' table?
Most definitely. I think in areas I mentioned there around pharma and environmental projects, energy areas. So I think that certainly people who are commissioning projects have a sustainability agenda, and engineers are going to have to deliver on that.
In terms of the people who are actually doing that on the ground, it doesn't seem as though the Irish workforce is able to keep up with the demand. And a lot of your members now are continuing anyway to look abroad to take staff on.
So, you know, very clearly in this survey, we would have seen about 50% of senior leaders are saying that they're looking abroad for talent. And even in terms of our own registrants, in 2016, about 20% of people registering with us would have been from outside of Ireland and the UK. Now it's up about 37%, and we expect to see that growing next year. So there certainly is a lot of demand, and we're seeing engineers responding to that. Engineering is one of those professions that you can travel all over the world with, and it's good to see people that are attracted to come to work in Ireland, but we need to do a lot to try and entice them and then help them to get established here.
In terms of the local workforce, though, you have done work to try and encourage Irish students to think about engineering when it comes to the CEO. Is that bearing fruit at all?
Yeah, it's very positive, and we're very thankful to particular industry leaders like ES ESB, TII, Arup, Intel, all of them have worked with us on programs to help to attract young people to engineering as a career. And they do that by showing what an engineer does. And we can see that in the projects coming out tonight. So 10% increase in the number of first preference awards for level 8 courses in engineering this year. That's one indicator, but it's a very positive indicator that young people are looking at STEM, but also particularly looking at engineering.
I imagine there are a lot of engineers out there with more traditional skills. Are there accessible and easy paths for them to move to some of the more modern applications that are increasingly in use now?
Yes. So again, another big leap we saw is that over 80% of employers are saying that they're going to take their current workforce and they're going to work with them about reskilling and upskilling. And again, I think one of the big drivers there is making sure that they're able to deal with the changes in technology. So again, as I said earlier, things like 3D printing, robotics, blockchain, all of these are areas where engineers want to be skilled in, as well as things like financial planning, management skills and communication. They're the things that are really coming out as being areas for development.
Caroline Spillane, Director General of Engineers Ireland, thank you for that. More business news in the next hour, though. It's back to you, Brian.
5 to 8, let's take a check on the weather prospects for the day ahead and indeed the weekend. Jean Byrne is at Met Air. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning. Well, our weather quite mixed for the next few days, but overall a good deal of dry weather. It'll be quite cold, though, with a risk of frost at night. Today, a dry day in most areas with sunny spells, but there'll be a few scattered showers, mostly in eastern and northwestern coastal areas. Highest temperatures 6 to 9 degrees, with mostly moderate north to northwest winds, but winds will be strong along eastern and southern coasts. Tonight, mostly dry with clear intervals, but very cold with widespread frost, some fog also, as winds slacken, and overnight temperatures minus 2 to plus 2 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly dry at first, with frost and fog gradually clearing. Cloud, though, will increase gradually from the Atlantic, and it'll bring some rain and drizzle by the end of the day, mainly to parts of the west and northwest. A very cold day with highs of just 4 to 8 degrees, but the winds will be light and variable. Sunday will be mostly and cloudy at first, with patchy rain and drizzle, but it'll brighten up gradually during the day and becoming dry in the afternoon with sunny spells. But a few isolated showers could occur along northern and eastern coasts. A cold day on Sunday again with highs of 6 to 9 degrees in mostly moderate northerly breezes. On Sunday night there'll be a widespread frost. It could be sharp or severe with a risk of icy patches and also some mist and fog. Monday is looking like a dry, bright day with frost and fog clearing gradually, possibly lingering on in some sheltered places. Highest temperatures only 5 to 8 degrees in light variable breezes. On Tuesday next, a spell of rain will extend gradually from the west and southwest in freshening southeast winds. Brighter conditions will follow into Munster and West Connacht later. And then it looks like being unsettled from Wednesday onwards, but a little bit milder from the middle of next week. Finally, a quick recap on today's weather. A dry day in most areas with sunny spells, but a few scattered showers will occur, mainly in eastern and northwestern coastal areas. Highest temperatures 6 to 9 degrees. That's all from us at Met Air. Good morning.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 15th of November. You're listening to More in Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Brian Dobson. The news is read now by Carla O'Brien.
The Fine Gael TD for Dunleary, Maria Bailey, has been deselected as a general election candidate by her party. The decision was taken by the party's national executive on foot of a recommendation by Fine Gael President and Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
Maria Bailey has been in deep political difficulty ever since it emerged she had taken a personal injuries case against a Dublin hotel after falling off a swing. Last month, she effectively lost the confidence of her constituency members in Dunleary, who called for an urgent review of general election candidates. Last night, the party president, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, recommended to his national executive that Maria Bailey be deselected and replaced by a local councillor, a recommendation which was endorsed. In a statement, Maria Bailey said she had worked hard to rebuild her reputation, but what she termed anonymous sources kept trying to reignite the swing story. However, the fact that the statement was released on party-headed paper and she described herself as a proud Fine Gael member suggests Deputy Bailey may not be minded to stand as an independent. Maria Bailey also said she will continue to fulfil her role as a public representative and, it's understood, is entitled to remain a member of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party. Fine Gael will be hoping last night's decision draws a line under what's been a bruising controversy.
The first ever youth assembly on climate change will take place in the Doyle Chamber at Leinster House today. 157 young people from across the country will gather to discuss what Ireland needs to do to tackle environmental issues. There will be coverage of proceedings on RTE News Now and on RTE2 television as part of RTE's Climate Week. On the eve of the assembly, the Taoiseach said he is inspired by young people battling climate change because they are forcing the issue to the top of the political agenda. Aisling Kenny reports.
Through protests, young people have helped make the climate crisis a national talking point. Today, Ireland's first ever youth assembly on climate will take place in the Dáil. It'll be a chance for 157 young people aged between 10 and 17 to discuss what Ireland needs to do to tackle environmental issues. The number of young delegates will be the same as the current number of TDs in the Dáil. Proceedings will be chaired by the Cian Comhairle Seán O'Farrill. Those selected will gather in groups to work out exactly what their proposals are on climate action. They'll focus on areas including environment, economics, food, farming, power and education, and their ideas will later be presented to politicians.
The latest round of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry into US President Donald Trump continue later today. The former US ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, who was recalled from her position last May, is due to testify before Congress. Democrats have accused President Trump of threatening to withhold military aid from Ukraine unless the country launched an investigation into his political rival, Joe Biden. Mr. Trump has posted tweets claiming that comments from officials in both countries showed he had not done so. At a rally in Louisiana last night, the US president described the impeachment process as already unraveling.
New remarks from top Ukrainian official damages Democrats' impeachment narrative. Just came out. I only read it because they don't like to report stories like this. You know about that.
The Israeli army said it launched fresh strikes against militant Islamic Jihad targets in Gaza as a truce put in place after fighting this week weakened. The development came after 5 rockets were fired at Israel from Gaza after the ceasefire came into effect yesterday. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon and the Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith will be among the participants at a British-Irish Council meeting chaired by the Taoiseach in Dublin this morning. The forum was set up as part of the Good Friday Agreement and Brexit is expected to feature prominently in today's discussions. Our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman.
It's 20 years since the first meeting of what's called a British-Irish Council took place. This will be the 33rd gathering. Heads of administrations from Scotland, Wales and the Channel Islands are travelling to Dublin. The Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith will represent the British government. Although next month's British general election will temper engagement about Brexit, the participants are due to discuss how the UK leaving the European Union might impact on relations between Ireland and the UK's regional administrations. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon is keen for the SNP to gain seats in the Westminster elections. She has a Scottish independence referendum on her wish list and believes more heft in the House of Commons would help achieve that goal. With no power-sharing administration in place at Stormont, Northern Ireland's executive will again be unrepresented at today's gathering.
A 41-year-old woman has died after being struck by a car while walking on the main Ennis to Kilrush Road in County Clare yesterday evening. Gardaí and the emergency services were called to the scene at Dara shortly after 7 o'clock. And the time now is just coming up to 6 minutes past eight.
RTÉ Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Dry in most areas today with sunny spells, but a few scattered showers will occur, mainly in eastern and northwestern coastal areas. Cold with highest temperatures of 6 to 9 degrees. Winds mostly moderate north to northwest, fresh to strong along eastern and southern coasts.
Swingate TD has been dramatically axed as a candidate for the next general election. That's how the Irish Daily Mail describes the case of Fine Gael deputy Maria Bailey. Emma Jane Haid reports that following the decision to drop Ms. Bailey, taken at a private meeting of the party's executive council in Dublin last night, the TD immediately hit back. She criticised the Fine Gael hierarchy's handling of the issue and said she would now take time to reflect on the matter. As the Irish Times notes, Maria Bailey came into the spotlight over a personal injury claim linked to a fall off a swing in a Dublin hotel, which was ultimately withdrawn. The Irish Independent's political correspondent John Downing comments that one would be inhuman not to have some sympathy for Maria Bailey's suffering, but she was also the author of her own downfall. A director of Quinn Industrial Holdings has said that many of the death threats made to the directors of the company were communicated face to face and then reported to police. So the Irish News reports in its lead story. John McCartan, a former Fine Gael councillor in County Leitrim, said he was repeatedly threatened by people he later identified to Gardaí. Mr. McCartan said he feared that police inaction meant the trail had gone cold on a lot of the information he provided since 2015. A Garda spokesman told the paper that the commissioner, Drew Harris, was happy with the progress of the investigation. The Irish Daily Mail and Irish Daily Mirror reports that information on mobile phones belonging to Cyril McGuinness, found during the raid on his house last Friday in connection with the investigation into the attack on Kevin Lunny, led to the arrests of two men and a woman yesterday. In the Irish Examiner, it was reported that the Garda ombudsman, GSOC, is looking into whether Gardaí properly investigated the complaint of a woman who said she had been repeatedly contacted by a judge who was dealing with her family law case. The woman alleges that the judge had contacted her by text and phone after she appeared before him. That story is by Michael Clifford. Get over the tracker rate scandal, says the lead headline in The Independent. That advice is a summary of the words of the head of the Belgian bank KBC, who the paper says has dismissed the central bank's crackdown on mortgage overcharging as annoying and called on Irish regulators to turn the page. What reporter Sean Pogachnik calls the tone-deaf remarks of Johan Theis came as the lender's Irish unit set aside another €18 million in expectation that a central bank fine could soon come for its role in blocking or removing customers from low-interest tracker mortgages a decade ago. People seeking to become Irish citizens will be relieved by the Court of Appeal overturning a ruling which stated that they could not leave the state at all in the year preceding their application. So the Irish Times reports in its lead story, quoting organisations working with migrants. The three-judge court described the ruling in July by Mr Justice Max Barrett in the High Court, which caused major uncertainty among applicants, as unworkable, unduly rigid and an interpretive absurdity. Terror at Tedfest is the headline in the Irish Sun. Gordon Deegan reports from Ennis Circuit Court, which heard yesterday that a drunken farmer pulled a fake gun from his pants during a violent row over cow dung at a popular Father Ted tribute event. With only 39 shopping days till Christmas, the Times reports that the business organisation responsible for installing Christmas lights in Dublin City is coming under increasing pressure to remove a new sign welcoming shoppers to the Grafton Quarter. The old sign in Grafton Street said Nullig Hunna Dit. The head of the Restaurants Association of Ireland is quoted as saying, "No one calls it the Grafton Quarter. They should just take it down and put the other sign back up." "What on earth is the Grafton Quarter?" asks Philip Nolan in a column in the Mail. He describes the new illuminated sign as a puerile rebranding exercise. "We demand our Nullig Hunna lights back," he says.
Racism and prejudice in public life have been in focus this week, with a number of high-profile politicians being accused of fomenting anti-immigrant sentiment and making offensive, silly and inappropriate comments. During leaders' questions on Tuesday, Independent TD for Galway West, Noel Grealish, overstated the amount of money sent home by Nigerians living in Ireland. And derogatory tweets by Fianna Fáil Senator and by-election candidate Lorraine Clifford Lee from a number of years ago surfaced, in which she insulted immigrants and the traveller community. Ms Clifford Lee is standing as a candidate in the upcoming by-election in Dublin Fingal. This week's Carol Coleman met her on the campaign trail in Malahide yesterday and asked her about the recent controversy surrounding the tweets from 2011, before her election to the Shannon in 2016.
what happened back then was totally inappropriate and wrong, and I'm very sorry for offending people. It was many years before I was engaged in electoral politics, and in no way reflects my opinion on minority issues. I've been my true attitude is reflected in what I've done and what I have said since I've been in a position to influence things. For example, I robustly defended in the media the families at Cabra Bridge last year in their dispute with Tipperary County Council. I supported the Traveller Education Bill, the granting of ethnic status to travellers, the Family Reunification Bill, which offered extra rights to undocumented migrant families in Ireland, and I also supported marriage equality. So I'm truly sorry for the offence that I caused. I think sometimes we say things when we don't understand the impact of the words that we use. I'm meeting Martin Collins. I've spoken to him on the phone. I'm going to reissue that apology to him in person, and I truly hope that my apology is accepted. It's from the bottom of my heart and it's very heartfelt, and I hope to engage in constructive dialogue with Martin and his colleagues.
And how do you feel about how this all has unfolded in the last few days, right in the middle of your campaign?
You know, it obviously was unexpected, but you know, as soon as it emerged, I apologised, and I've kept apologising, and I will continue to apologise because that's all I can do. I am genuinely very, very sorry. It doesn't reflect who I am. It doesn't reflect the work that I've engaged in, and I know that I have caused offence, and I'm truly sorry for that offence.
Do you accept that people, particularly in public life, have to be very careful about what they say about other people and how they label other groups?
Absolutely. And it's something that happened far before I was involved in electoral politics. Nevertheless, I understand the impact that the words I used has had on people, and I understand the offence that I have caused. And I'm truly, truly sorry for that offence.
There might be some people out there who'd say, that's who she is, she wrote those words, you can't change them. How do you sort of disassociate yourself from something that was your own words?
It was a long time ago, and I suppose we all evolve as people. And, you know, I'm now a mother, and I suppose I have educated myself a lot in relation to minority issues in recent years. And you know, people make mistakes, and it's the recognition of those mistakes, and it's how you act. And since I have been a public person, that was in a private capacity, since I have been a public person, I have worked very, very hard in relation to minority issues.
Are there any other tweets or anything on other platforms that may yet emerge?
I don't know is the straight answer, because, you know, obviously this was a long time ago before I was engaged in electoral politics, and I'm very, very sorry for things I might have said back then.
What are your thoughts generally on the value and the challenges of diversity?
Well, Ireland is a more diverse country than we have been in the past, and particularly this constituency, it's very, very diverse. And this constituency is a very young constituency, and it's a rapidly growing constituency, and there's people coming from all over Dublin, all over Ireland and beyond to live in this constituency. And I think it's very important that we put the structures there in place in all our communities, that we can all integrate, get to know each other and grow as communities.
That was Carol Coleman speaking to Senator Lorraine Clifford Lee there. Carol will have a constituency profile of Dublin Fingal on This Week on Sunday. And Martin Collins of Pavey Point, who Lorraine Clifford Lee is meeting this morning, told this programme that he will accept her apology, as that will acknowledge the hurt and humiliation caused to the traveller community. The other candidates in that constituency are Joe O'Brien of the Green Party, James Riley of Fine Gael, Duncan Smith of Labour, Dean Mulligan of Independence for Change, Anne Graves of Sinn Féin, Gemma O'Doherty Independent, Tracy Carey of Social Democrats, Glenn Brady Independent and Cormac McKay Independent. It's 18 minutes past 8.
Next to a rare but revealing insight this morning into what one top banker really thinks about the Tracker mortgage scandal, in which 40,000 homeowners were overcharged by their lenders, some lost their homes, and the banks involved have so far had to pay out €700 million in fines and compensation. According to the Group Chief Executive of KBC Bank, Johan Thies, The central bank investigation into the scandal is annoying, and it's time to move on. Speaking on a conference call with financial analysts yesterday following the release of KBC's third quarter results, Mr. Thies said the inquiry was hampering growth and urged the regulator to turn the page.
What is still an annoying thing is the whole tracker mortgage stuff. Honestly, I would recommend the Central Bank of Ireland, come on guys, turn the page. Let's focus on doing business. We have learned our lessons. We know what to do. Let's know. Stop doing old nitty-gritty stuff, which is an administrative hampering of the development of the financial institution and the financial market as a whole in Ireland. Let's turn that page and then really go into business.
On primetime last night, the chief executive of the Banking and Payments Federation, Brian Hayes, said the KBC boss's comments were unfortunate, but he wouldn't be drawn on whether he was wrong to say what he said.
Those remarks were unfortunate at one level, but at another level they express a frustration about the length of time that the tracker scandal investigation is taking, the kind of drip-drip we are
well,
seeing.
Well, in fairness, that's hardly the central bank's fault.
And the central bank have to be supported in getting to an end of this. The outcome has to be for the 40,000 plus impacted customers, that they get justice, recompense. And the banks, listen, I am not going to defend what the banks did. The banks do not defend what they did. We need to move to a healthy new position. 26,500 Irish people work in Irish banks. They're important. We're not going to get to a better position
as
a country.
Was he wrong to say what he did?
Well, I think they were unfortunate, those comments. But I think you have to understand the frustration of a lot of people about the length of time that this investigation is taking.
Brian Hayes of the Banking and Payments Federation. We're joined here in studio by Pura Kassan, financial advisor who represented many hundreds of homeowners caught up in the tracker mortgage scandal. A very good morning to you, and thank you for coming to talk to the programme. And Mr. Thies says that we have learned our lessons, we know what to do. Have they?
When I saw the words or heard the words that was brought to my attention yesterday, ironically, I was coming from an oral hearing where an appeal for a husband and wife dealing with the fallout effects of what occurred. And I found his comments insensitive, but more worryingly, I suppose, they showed a clear lack of empathy with what occurred and a lack of understanding of the effects of what happened. I saw it as ironic, some of the words he used about nitty-gritty stuff and administrative hampering, when he's talking about a lender that resisted this investigation, resisted the Finance Committee, his own bank. And he says it has taken 10 years, and Brian Hayes said it took 10 years. The reason it has taken that length of time is the banks didn't acknowledge that there was a wrong in the first place. And it took a huge amount of effort to get banks like KBC to the table of understanding that there was a wrong in the first place.
What in particular has been your experience representing mortgage holders with KBC? How have they as an institution dealt with this?
Well, I brought with me this morning the report I sent to the Central Bank. It's over 130 pages because this bank had put out the soundboards that there was no issue with them. There was no issue of trackers at all. They have resisted everything that I ever wrote was wrong. They argued against it. They defended their position, as they're entitled to do, but they were wrong. And I suppose the concern I would have in what's being put out from yesterday, this was the parent, the CEO of the parent bank. And this bank was also bailed out, I might add, by the Belgian government and sought state aid, which they have repaid, I might add. But I think what concerns me here is the, I suppose, there are people that were affected to such a degree that they can't simply flip a page as he would like everybody to do here. Mm-hmm. They can't. They have to live with the consequences of this. It's interesting when he says how long it takes. The overcharging went on here for 10 years in some instances, and that caused economic and personal and stressful difficulties which reached far beyond, with all due respect to the CEO, that can't be just flipped over. These people are dealing with the fallout of this and will have to continue to deal with it.
We know we've had in recent times, as a result of this scandal, a lot of talk about changing the culture in our banks. There's now a banking culture board to address just this issue. The culture of an institution, of course, is very often set by those at the top. Does Mr. Thies now need to withdraw these remarks or clarify them in some way?
Well, I would ask him to do two things. I would certainly ask him to withdraw or clarify what he meant. But you'll get a PR spin on it then, Brian. That's what will happen there, because it's the CEO of the bank. The regret I would have is there are good people in KBC in Ireland who are trying and attempting to change the culture, because they come into the board of the culture board. We have a program in place already, a work program in place to try and change these things. But I think the comments yesterday, if ever it was needed to be highlighted, highlight the level of work and the challenge that's ahead for the culture board in particular. But it won't be easy, and it never was going to be.
What about the comments of Brian Hayes? We heard them there. Unfortunate is the term he used to describe Mr. Thien's remarks. What's your reaction to that response from someone who's a spokesman for the Irish banking sector?
I mean, why the words are chosen so carefully is just beyond me. Call it as it is. I mean, there would be a lot more respect and trust rebuilt, because people spoke about restoring trust. Restoring trust isn't going to happen. It actually has to be rebuilt. But when Brian Hayes comes out and uses words unfortunate, it's as if it's to dilute the importance of the effect. And he's missing the point. People, I've said this umpteen times, people are not upset about how much money was taken from them. They're upset that it was taken in the first place, because they trusted banks to look after them and so forth. And that point is consistently missed by commentators such as Mr. Hayes, who ironically at one point fleecing customers and of the other thing. So it's a change, but you need to understand it.
And his complaint or his point that this is something which is taking longer than it should to resolve, the phrase he used was this drip-drip approach.
Well, the reason it's taking the length of time is because it was such a broad investigation and such an important investigation. Secondly, it wouldn't have taken any time. It wouldn't have even occurred if the banks that he's speaking about hadn't done it in the first place. There would have been no investigation if they had done right by their customers from day one.
Padraig Cassan there, we leave it. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us on Morning Ireland this morning. It's
just under a month to go now to the general election in the UK, called by Prime Minister Boris Johnson to get Brexit done. The deadline for declaring passed yesterday. This morning, the election headlines and front pages in Britain see Boris Johnson petting a rabbit on the front page of the Times, Labour promising free broadband for all, a Conservative tax cuts promise on the Express, Nigel Farage waving from a train on the Telegraph, the NHS and flooding on other papers, not a mention of Brexit. Matthew Goodwin is Senior Visiting Fellow with Chatham House and a political analyst at the University of Kent. Matthew, good morning.
Good morning.
A snap election with not much crackle or pop yet.
Well, indeed, this has been a fairly quiet election, no major story so far, perhaps with the exception of Nigel Farage saying that he's now going to stand down his Brexit Party candidates in the 317 Conservative-held seats. But overall, perhaps the only other thing to attract attention are these spending commitments, both from Labour and the Conservative Party, which would suggest that the era of austerity is now truly coming to an end.
Let's go back to the role of Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party, and what role you think that they will have ultimately in the election outcome.
Well, this is one variable that could have a very big impact, even though the polls suggest that Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party are on course for an 8 or 9 point lead and a majority, perhaps a small majority, but still a majority. The problem, however, is what happens if a few things go wrong. If Boris Johnson loses some seats in Scotland, if the Liberal Democrats in the South pressure the Conservatives, if Labour continues its expansion beyond London, that's when Nigel Farage becomes critical, because if Boris Johnson is pinning his hopes on those Labour Leave seats to offset any losses in Remain areas, then Nigel Farage standing those candidates, even if they get 2 or 3% of the vote, could be enough to cost Boris Johnson the entire election and, by extension, paving the way for a second referendum.
You mentioned Scotland. Why does Scotland matter in this election?
Well, Scotland matters because it's changed the game at British elections, really. The SNP becoming so strong north of the border has removed a large number of seats for Labour and the Conservatives, which in turn is making it much harder for both of them to win an overall majority. At this particular election, what matters is that the Conservative Party are hoping to hold on to a significant number of their seats, again to offset against any losses to the Lib Dems and Labour in mainly southern England. The Labour Party, meanwhile, is hoping not to be completely wiped out in Scotland, is looking for some sign of resurgence, while the SNP, which could, in theory, emerge as some sort of coalition partner with the Labour Party, is hoping that a strong performance would pave the way for that second independence referendum.
There's a long way to go in this campaign, and while the polls haven't changed much, we are mindful of what happened in relation to the polls and the eventual outcome in 2017, where the Conservatives went into the election with a very large lead, but which was almost wiped out by polling day. Is the likelihood of a hung parliament veering into view again, much like it did 2 years ago?
A hung parliament is entirely plausible. Even though the Conservatives have a lead in the polls, if you look at where we are, just basically a month out from the election, the Conservatives are averaging 40%, Labour 28%. A month out from the 2017 election 2 years ago, Labour were on 28%. And of course, they then saw that big surge as they squeezed the Greens, they squeezed the Liberal Democrats, and they attracted back undecided Labour voters. What's happening today? We're now seeing a little bit of evidence that Labour is squeezing the Liberal Democrats, and we've got a little bit of evidence that Labour are beginning to increase a little bit in the polls, and I wouldn't be surprised if next week they slip into the 30s. So that really means that in order to try and hold on to this majority that in theory Boris Johnson has in the polls, he's going to have to hope that the volatility in British politics doesn't reappear. And remember, between 2010 and 2017, no less than 49% of voters switched their vote from one party to another. This is the most volatile electorate we've ever had, and that means really sudden, sharp shifts during the campaign, a campaign which is not yet being set alight, but could easily come alight by a specific event. A lot of change could yet happen.
And this day, 4 weeks, we'll have the results for you. Matthew Godwin, thank you very much for speaking to us. That's Matthew Goodwin, Senior Visiting Fellow at Chatham House. It's just gone 8:30.
Carpetright has agreed to be taken private by its largest shareholder, Meditor, in a deal valuing the company at £15.2 million. Meditor already owns almost 30% of the retailer and has already loaned a significant sum of money to the company. Carpetright operates 449 stores, including 20 in Ireland. It says the acquisition is not expected to lead to a material job losses, but some redundancies are expected from ongoing changes to its retail footprint. Meanwhile, Eddie Stobart Logistics has agreed to sell a controlling stake in the business to Douglas Bay Capital. As part of the deal, the investment company will inject around £55 million of funding into the group. And 15 members of the World Trade Organization have demanded compromises from the EU and Britain to ensure foreign businesses do not lose market access in a post-Brexit trade. The complaint relates to trade quotas, which allow set amounts of some products to be sold with no or reduced tariffs. The EU's quotas will have to be split as part of the Brexit process, and countries including the US, India, Australia and Canada want to ensure their producers do not have reduced market access as a result. Finally, the currency markets, €1 buying you US dollar and 10.2 cent and 85.6 pence sterling.
Des Cahill here at the Sports News again. Morning, Des.
Good morning to you, Gavin. The Republic of Ireland beat New Zealand 3-1 in last night's international friendly. Despite Ireland going behind to a Callum McCowatt goal, the inexperienced Irish team dominated the game and were comfortable winners. There were three first-time goal scorers for Ireland. Derek Williams of Blackburn levelled the game at 1-1 just before half-time. Then in the second half, Preston's Seanie Maguire and Callum Robinson of Sheffield United added two more. Maguire was named man of the match.
He was excellent. Yeah, he was in training this week, actually, and he got two or three times in training. He finished him, and I thought he was going to score with a one. In the first half, they got a great goal in there and it was a terrific finish.
Now, there were a lot of other good performances. Well, we were mentioning there while watching the replays, Leo O'Connor's cross for Callum Robinson's goal, exceptional.
It was brilliant, and we thought he had a few opportunities in the first half. I remember Robbie coming and said, he should put the ball in, and he cut back. With deliveries like that, we'll score goals, and it was a fabulous, fabulous cross, yeah. Delighted with him. I was telling him to come off at the end because I thought he said he just started to tighten up. He was just fatigued, I think. So, welcome to the real world.
Josh Cullen played the full 92-93 minutes. The two keepers you played both made good saves. You've got plenty of choices now for Monday.
Yeah, the two keepers good, and I see Trav comes on and saves a great save from their substitute that's come on. I thought Josh Cullen was excellent. I thought Brownie was as well. Really good performances from those two, so really pleased.
Yes, Mick McCarthy said he was also pleased with the performance of Troy Parrott in his first start for the Irish senior side. Parrott is only 17 years old. Elsewhere, England, the Czech Republic, Turkey and France all secured their places at next summer's European finals. England won 7-0 against Montenegro at Wembley, with Harry Kane scoring a first-half hat-trick. France came from a goal down to win 2-1 at home to Moldova, and the holders Portugal were 6-0 winners at home to Lithuania. Another hat-trick here for Cristiano Ronaldo, the 55th of his career, his 98th international goal. Tonight there are two games of huge significance in Ireland's group. Denmark host Gibraltar and Switzerland are at home to Georgia. At the moment, Ireland and Denmark are on 12 points and Switzerland are on 11. Ireland have played one game more. So if, as expected, Denmark and Switzerland win their home games tonight, the group would change significantly. Denmark on 15, Switzerland on 14 and Ireland on 12. In which case, obviously, Ireland must beat Denmark on Monday to go ahead of them on a head-to-head basis. The Irish under-21s won again yesterday. Their 1-0 win in Armenia means Ireland continue to top that group, but Ireland have played more games. Tonight, the Irish under-17s play Montenegro at Turner's Cross in a European qualifier. A blow for Clare footballers yesterday with the news that Gary Brennan will not play inter-county next season. In tennis, Roger Federer stunned Novak Djokovic to reach the semi-finals of the ATP Tour Finals in London. His victory also ended the Serbians' bid to finish the year as world number one. The 38-year-old Swiss came through a straight shootout in the group stage with his great rival to win 6-4, 6-3. Rafa Nadal will now top the world rankings. In snooker, the Northern Ireland Open in Belfast saw a surprise defeat for Mark Allen, who lost 4-3 to the Swiss outsider Alexander Erstenbacher. Ken Doherty was beaten 4-1 by Mark Selby. Now in rugby, the European Champions Cup gets underway this evening. The opening match sees Gloucester host Toulouse. All four Irish provinces are in action over the weekend. Munster are in Wales to play the Ospreys tomorrow evening. That game will be live on Saturday Sport. Joey Carberry is out injured, so Tyler Blaindell will be number 10. He says playing for Munster in Europe is quite special.
Yeah, it's almost hard to explain, even being a part of it. When Munster step on the field in a European competition, there just seems to be a bit of extra there that they give as a team. And so, look, we're hoping no different this week, but there's going to be a massive challenge over in Wales for us against the Ospreys, and we're going to have to prepare well, make sure we turn up mentally, and we're going to be aware we're going to be ready for a massive challenge. Every point's massive, and I think the last few seasons we've started with a draw. Those points, those little extra points are crucial, but I don't know if there's easy pools in European competition, to be honest, and everyone's striving to top the pool and get those home playoff spots, I guess. So this week's our focus, and it's a massive game for us. As far as we're concerned, it's the biggest of the season so far, and we go from there.
Now, since Stephen Narcombe has come here, what's your reaction been sort of working with him, probably even to the news that he was coming here? Because, I mean, he was a world-class number 10 in terms of his coaching, a man who's obviously got a lot of knowledge to impart on everybody.
Yeah, a lot of knowledge, and he's sharing it around. He helps out all the position groups, which is great. Just the way we look at film and review our play and how we train on the field, we're just evolving, which is great. He challenges everyone, and especially as 10s, challenging our skills and our decision making. So it's been great on a personal level. And look, as a team, I think we can also evolve, and he's forcing us to see things differently and maybe make some changes where necessary.
That's Tyler Blaindell. Now, Connacht play Montpellier in Galway, and the Connacht coach, Andy Friend, has his first game in charge in Europe's Premier competition.
It's a big league, isn't it? So Montpellier here, big men, they'll be right up for that, and they'll probably be watching last week's game and thinking we got a good chance against Connacht. You've got to win your home games in Champions Cup, so that's our target. We've got Montpellier travelling here. Normally the French don't like to travel too much. Maybe we'll turn the weather on, we'll wait and see, but we'll make life as uncomfortable as you can for them here, and hopefully that's enough to get us the win. They're just big physical men, internationals throughout their pack and throughout their back line, but if we get in an arm wrestle, we're probably going to lose that one, so we don't want to be in that arm wrestle. We want to open the game up a bit and play our style of attacking rugby.
That's Andy Friend. Now, in Racing, Horse Racing Ireland has confirmed that all registrations under the Supreme Racing Club banner have been voided following the failure of the club's trustee to provide HRI with information requested. It means that their 14 horses, including Big Cheltenham Hope, Kenboy, will not be permitted to race in Ireland. Duvan made a winning return to action at Clonmel yesterday after more than 500 days of inactivity with an impressive victory. Today's opening day of Cheltenham's November meeting has been cancelled. There was very heavy rain over the last couple of days. The course flooded in places. Another inspection today to see if tomorrow's big meeting can go ahead. But there will be action at home in Dundalk starting at 5:15.
157 young people will take over the Dáil today for the RTE Youth Assembly on Climate. It's part of centenary celebrations at Leinster House, where young people will be making recommendations on tackling climate change. Cian McCormack joins us from there. Cian, the build-up is starting as we speak.
Yeah, that's correct, Brian. Right now, teenagers from all over the country are collecting their accreditation for this assembly. They have a photo call at 9:30 on the steps in the front of the Dáil of Leinster House. And then five delegates will address the youth assembly in the Dáil at 10 o'clock. Those addresses can be watched on RTÉ2 television, RTÉ News Now, and on Oireachtas TV. There'll also be workshops and presentations throughout the day, and then after 2 o'clock, recommendations and proposals on how to tackle climate change will be presented to the Cean Comhairle in the Dáil. Well, I'll be talking to two teenagers who are taking part in the assembly and the Cean Comhairle, Sean O'Farrell, in a few moments. But first, I got the views of Taoiseach Leo Varadkar on today's event.
Well, I have to say I'm really glad that it's happening. I think young people are really leading the way on this issue. They're the ones who, I think, understand the science. They're the ones who get it. And they're the ones who are demanding action from adults and from politicians and people in power and influence in politics and business and in society. So I've been really inspired, I have to say, by the extent to which young people have taken this issue on and really forced all of us to put it very near the top of our agenda.
The Youth Assembly on Climate will make recommendations to the Cean Comhairle in the Dáil during the afternoon. But can those recommendations translate into policy?
Well, I suppose it depends on what they are. And what I'll do once the event is over is arrange to meet the Cean Comhairle in the next couple of weeks, allow him and maybe a delegation from the group of young people to meet with me and Richard Bruton, and we can see what the recommendations are. So I'm very determined that if we take climate action, we need to make sure it's poverty-proofed, that we don't, as a result of climate action, increase poverty or increase unemployment. We need to bear in mind the impact on rural areas and rural communities in particular who have particular concerns. And we also need to consider things like other demands, for example, like housing. We need to build a lot more houses in the years to come, and that will involve concrete, it will involve new roads, it will involve things that aren't necessarily good for the environment. But would anyone seriously argue that we don't need more housing? We do. So we'll look at the recommendations and we'll look at them in the round as well.
On Taoiseach Leo Varadkar there. Well, joining me now is Cean Comhairle, Sean O'Farrell. Cean Comhairle, this is part of Dáil centenary celebrations. You've been pushing the Youth Assembly on Climate. Why?
Well, look, it's a hugely symbolic day for us, I think, here in Leinster House. What I've been looking forward to for quite some time, and I commend RTÉ and being the initiator of this. So the symbolism of this is terribly important, but so too is achieving a practical outcome.
Practical outcome
will be a series of proposals that these young people will agree on and that will then be presented to every member of the Oireachtas and to government, and then will hopefully and quite confidently be acted upon by government.
Joining me also here are 17-year-old Conal O'Boyle from Donegal and 14-year-old Saoirse Exton from Limerick. Well, first, Conal, you'll be addressing the assembly at 10 o'clock this morning. What will your message be?
Well, Cian, you know, the message has stayed the same. I mean, yes, sure, the platform has been amplified. We've gone from the streets to the seats, you could say, this morning. But the message is going to stay the same. You know, what young people all over Ireland have been calling out for over 12 months is that we want climate action now. And these demonstrations that have gone on every week, like Saoirse will tell you, is a clear saying, you know, that, you know, these aren't just words, this is action that we want. And, you know, just the message has stayed the same, but this is a bigger platform.
What do you hope you'll achieve?
Well, what we hope to achieve is the same what we've always hoped to achieve, and that's for politicians that are usually in there to hear us, to listen to us, as the Cean Comhairle said, to endorse what we propose today. But sure, that's what we've always wanted. You know?
Saoirse, you've been holding climate strikes in Limerick over the past year. I think the count is 38. Have they been worth it?
Yes, they have definitely been worth it, yeah, sorry.
And do you think what you raise here at the Assembly today will make a difference?
I hope that it will. I mean, I have concerns about how radical it will be. I have concerns about, you know, will the proposals actually, will they be enough, you know, to combat climate change? So I hope, but I don't know, you know.
You're getting ready for the event to start. What's your mood right now?
I'm a bit nervous and I'm a bit, to be frank, annoyed, if you know what I mean. I feel
annoyed?
Yeah. I feel that this is sort of, we've been pitted against each other, if you know what I mean. From the start, we've had to have a competition with our proposals. You know, we've had to, the proposals were voted on. There was only six allowed. There's only five people going to be able to speak in the Dáil. And now I feel like as young people who are interested in climate change, we should be coming together and we should be creating something together instead of doing something in separate groups and having walls between us.
Ciara Corla, I'll let you pick up on that point.
I understand that there may be some logistical difficulties, but this is our first effort, maybe the first of many further engagements. But you know what? The young people have put a clarion call out to us here, a wake-up call. The Taoiseach had said we were laggards. We're about the business now of demonstrating that we've left that behind us and we are determined to move forward and be realistic in tackling this challenge and using our international moral authority to signal to other countries that we want this matter dealt with.
Finally, Ciara Corla, we've hit on the recommendations earlier on. They'll be made by the Assembly on climate here today, but the big question is really, will they be listened to and can it translate into policy?
Well, here, I'm going to make a clear guarantee to you. These recommendations will be passed to every one of the 157 TDs and they will be passed to government and we will take the Taoiseach up on his generous offer that we will seek a meeting with him at his earliest possible convenience. And I am personally committed to pursuing these objectives.
Finally, Saoirse, briefly, are you happy with that?
Yeah, I am. Again, just to repeat myself, I hope that it's enough.
You hope that it's enough. Well, Ciara Corla, Sean O'Farrell, Conal O'Boyle from Donegal and Saoirse Jackson from Limerick, thank you for joining me on this fresh morning here outside Leinster House. And good luck with the Assembly. So, Brian, just to recap on today's events, the Youth Assembly on Climate starts at 10 o'clock and recommendations from it will be presented to the Ciara Corla in the Dáil after 2 o'clock. But for now, it's back to you in studio.
Thanks, Cadeen. I think I can also say that the proceedings will be broadcast on RTE News Now and on Oireachtas Television as part of RTE's Climate Week. Thank you for that. 5 to 9.
A pet is not just for Christmas. A charity that takes care of abandoned horses is worried that gifts of small foals and ponies at this time of year can often end up neglected, damaged, or ultimately set loose. Last year, just under 1,500 horses were seized by local authorities across the country. Hundreds were reclaimed or rehoused, but just over 1,000 horses were euthanised. Martina Kenny is here. She's the CEO of the charity My Lovely Horse, named after, of course, the song in Father Ted, our second Father Ted reference of the morning. Tell me, Martina, about the kind of calls that you get to your charity.
We get a lot of messages and calls every single day. People all over Ireland really concerned about different horses in housing estates, fields, just concerned at the fact they have no water sometimes, no food, grass dies for winter, they're in, you know, fields of just muck, so absolutely nothing to eat. And then also a lot of people calling about horses in housing estates. So, you know, urban horses left in back gardens, left in front gardens, on greens, which would be council land, you know, abandoned fields or whatever. So It's wrong. First of all, they have no shelter, they have no food, no care, and a horse does cost a lot of money if it gets sick.
Horses as presents, yes?
Yeah. I spoke to two parents only a while ago, and both their sons, one 12 and one 10, had got horses for a communion and confirmation. One was €50 and the other was €100, and they completely thought that that was absolutely fine.
And in some cases, it's the children buying the horses themselves with their communion or confirmation
yeah,
money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, or they swap mobile phones. You know, we've had many horses in that have been swapped for a mobile phone.
If you hear, if somebody rings you to say that they're worried about a horse, about the condition they're in or where they're being kept, what can you do then?
Well, what we do is we ask for the area. We don't obviously say the name of the person, but we do ask for photo, if they can take a photo or video. It's just good to have proof as well. We contact local guards, depending on where it is, and we then contact the councils and the Department of Agriculture.
Now, you house, or you essentially, you take care of horses that are abandoned. I'm just looking at your website for people who would like to foster, to adopt, to rehouse these horses, for those who have the space, the money, the time, the energy to do it. They can go to, rather than doing it through other means, they can, a little bit like with abandoned dogs or cats, they can go to your charity to get a horse. Yes,
like a foster is a great way to know, you know, if you do have some land and a shelter and you have a little bit of experience, or we can help you with that. It's a great way to see if your family are ready for such a big animal, because it is a very expensive thing. Like a horse can get sick and like colic, for instance. And if that happens, you know, it could be a big, huge vet bill going straight to UCD for an operation or whatever. They don't seem to understand that. A lot of the people that, you know, especially the urban areas that have horses, they're not thinking about that at all. It's like a quad bike. So when it's finished with, it's just thrown there.
Martina, thank you very much for coming into us this morning. That's Martina Kenny, she's CEO of the charity My Lovely Horse. 2 minutes to 9.